a major argument used in the defence of Israeli genocide of the Palestinians today across the planet is that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. The sixth edition of the Merriam-Webster International Dictionary makes this equation in its second definition of anti-Semitism, criticism of Israel. Now, the Israeli regime and many of its supporters, of course, have the same view. Criticism of Israel is the same as anti-Semitism. And this is a powerful kind of an argument because at least in the West, anybody but a Nazi fuckwit knows that anti-Semitism is a bad thing. And you don't want to be called an anti-Semite because it's bad. What's more, if Goys who talk about are critical of Israel are anti-Semites, Goys being a slightly pejorative Yiddish term for non-Jews, if they are anti-Semites, what about people like me who are Jews and are critical of Israel? Well, we can be dismissed quite easily under the heading of being a self-hating Jew. In other words, we have something psychologically wrong with us, we don't like ourselves, and therefore we take it out on ourselves by being critical of Israel, which amounts to anti-Semitism. But a big question I think that we have to ask is this issue of anti-Semitism, how big an issue is it in the world today? And more concretely, apart from the question of anti-Semitism, which can be nasty words about Jews, how significant an issue is the oppression of Jews in a country like Australia, or the United States, or in Western Europe? Are Jews an oppressed group in Australia? I think that the answer has to be that Jews are not an oppressed group here, nor are they an oppressed group in Western Europe or in North America. Now, this is not to say that anti-Semitism is perfectly acceptable. It can be ignored because Jews aren't an oppressed group. Anti-Semitism is a real anti-Semitism that blames Jews for the problems of society is a form of poison. It's a reactionary form of poison, and whenever it comes up, we should be prepared to take it on. But that's a different issue from the one of, are Jews oppressed? Is this an important issue in Australian society, a cutting-edge issue, where in taking it on, we will be confronting the forces in power, the capitalist class and the state? And I think there the answer has to be no. It's worth saying that while in the West the idea that anti-Semitism is pretty bad is just common sense, this is not the same in other parts of the world. Elsewhere, particularly in the Muslim and Arab world, various anti-Semitic ideas are quite widespread, largely as a consequence of the acceptance of the disastrous Zionist identification of Jews and Israel. For those who support the State of Israel, for most of those who support the State of Israel, all Jews have an interest in the State of Israel, and Israel acts in the interests of all Jews. And on that basis, anti-Semitic ideas are quite widespread in non-Western parts of the world. But I'll come back to that later on. So, in Australia, one hears anti-Semitic comments. I personally take offence to them. They're unpleasant. They have to be opposed. But it doesn't take a lot of courage to oppose anti-Semitism in Australia. On the other hand, standing up to anti-Muslim racism in Australia, standing up to anti-Arab racism in Australia is something that is of a different order entirely. Because Muslims and Arabs in Australia are oppressed. It's not just a question of nasty words about them. It's a question of governments who lock Muslims and Arabs up, particularly if they arrive by boat, because they are seen as some sort of a security threat. Because of anti-terrorism laws that can lock people away for a long period of time for mouth and thought crimes, rather than for people having actually done anything if they're Muslims and Arabs. So here and throughout the Western world, really, anti-Muslim and anti-Arab racism is a serious problem. These are oppressed groups, and this is a cutting-edge kind of an issue. If we're going to understand the use of arguments about anti-Semitism to justify the Israeli oppression of the Palestinian people, then I think it's worth being clear about the nature of anti-Semitism and also about the nature of Zionism. Anti-Jewish sentiment in Europe is extremely old. It goes back a long, long way, promoted by the Christian churches actually over millennia. But modern anti-Semitism is a form of racism attributing bad characteristics to people on the basis of their race, and that's really what anti-Semitism is about, is a much more modern kind of a development, a modern development of the second half of the 19th century. It emerged as a tool of reactionaries, especially in Eastern and Central Europe. In Germany from the 1870s onwards, it was used as a weapon in trying to mobilise support for the existing order, for the undemocratic imperial order, against a working class that was beginning to organise. The same was true in occupied Poland, if Poland wasn't a separate state, and Austria-Hungary from the 1890s onwards. In Russia, there were pogroms, in other words, murderous riots against Jews between 1882 and 1884, and then from 1903 to 1906, particularly in the wake of the 1905 revolution. In 1905, for example, there was a pogrom in Odessa, the port city on the Black Sea, where 2,500 people were killed by Black Hundreds, which were essentially reactionary bands that supported the autocracy, supported the Tsar, the established order, the established church, and so on, and blamed the problems of society on the Jews. And the emergence of modern anti-Jewish sentiment, anti-Semitism, a form of racism, coincides with the need by conservative and reactionary forces in society to mobilise mass popular support in the face of elements of democracy being introduced in Western Europe and in the face of the emergence of mass politics of a left-wing kind in Eastern Europe. How are you going to get people who are oppressed and exploited by the established order to support that order in the face of confrontation by the left? Well, the answer that they stumbled across and then they developed was, we will blame the problems that people face, real problems of poverty, of oppression, on somebody else. And the Jews were a convenient somebody else because they looked a bit different, particularly Orthodox Jews looked a bit different, they dressed differently, and they were part of Eastern European society that could be identified as they're the source of the problem. It's not those above. The Tsar, the little father, he has your interests at stake, but these bloody Jews, they're the ones who are gouging you and charging you too much in business transactions and so on. And by the way, did you know that they needed baby's blood to make matzah, which is the unleavened bread at Passover? This sort of stuff, they're the problem that you really face. And if you want to really address the problems that you're facing, then you've got to look to doing something about the Jews. There was an exodus of all sorts of people from Eastern Europe and to some extent from Central Europe in the late 19th century, because basically these semi-feudal parts of Europe, especially the Russian Empire and the eastern parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they were bloody good places to live. And this was because of poverty, because of oppression, discrimination and so on. This was true of non-Jews and Jews alike. There was significant movements of people westward into Western Europe and also across the Atlantic into North America, particularly into the United States. And there were more Jews in Western Europe from the late 19th century on, and anti-Semitism became a real factor in politics in Western Europe, signalled really by the Dreyfus Affair in France between 1894 and 1906, when essentially a secular Jew, a guy called Alfred Dreyfus, who was a captain in the French army, was framed up for having leaked military secrets to the Germans. He was framed, he was condemned, and he was sent to one of the worst penal institutions that the French state had on Devil's Island, and it was an incredible travesty of any kind of notion of justice. In fact, there had been somebody leaking military secrets to the Germans, who was an impeccably Catholic officer who had the right kind of semi-aristocratic background. But, you know, it was much easier to pick on a Jew. And this was an occasion for, not that anti-Semitism hadn't been known before in France, but it was an occasion for a significant rise in the anti-Semitic temperature in France. Now, there were a variety of reactions to the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe in the late 19th century, or from the late 19th century on. I'll start with the good first. That's a principled socialist response to anti-Semitism, which is to emphasise the importance of class unity, to point out that anti-Semitism was a response to real problems, but it was a response that pointed in absolutely the wrong direction. This was the response of Marxists of the Social Democratic Party in Germany. In 1884, the German Social Democratic Party stood a guy called Paul Singer for both the Berlin City Council and also for a seat in the German Parliament in the Reichstag. He, long-standing member, he also happened not only to be Jewish, but actually a clothing manufacturing boss. This was in the midst of an anti-Semitic campaign run by reactionaries that was trying to appeal to workers. The Social Democrats stood a member of theirs who was committed, very clear politically, who was Jewish. They stood him in the centre of the anti-Semitic agitation in order to make a political point about anti-Semitism. Those of you who went to Janie's talk yesterday about Jewish struggles from the Lower East Side to the Warsaw Ghetto will no doubt have heard about the struggles of the Bund, which was the largest Marxist organisation in the Russian Empire until 1906, and its fight against anti-Semitism, weapons in hand, against the pogroms during the 1905 revolution. So that's one approach. There was also an opportunist approach within the socialist movement, exemplified in particular by the Social Democratic Workers' Party of Austria, which denounced anti-Semitism, so far so good, and it also denounced philo-Semitism. What is philo-Semitism, you ask? Well, that's a very good question. Philo-Semitism is liking the Jews. Now, this philo-Semitism wasn't exactly a major issue with Jews who were being discriminated against in Austria-Hungary. Jews, most of the Jews in Austria-Hungary, their mother tongue, their mamaloschen, was Yiddish. Yiddish wasn't recognised. No document that was written in Yiddish was recognised legally in Austria-Hungary. You couldn't testify in Yiddish before a court. There was unofficial discrimination in terms of recruitment to various state institutions against Jews. Philo-Semitism was not an issue. This was a fudge to try and appear to be even-handed. It was a concession to anti-Semitism in practice. There are also liberal responses to anti-Semitism, ranging from fairly radical criticism of what was wrong with anti-Semitic ideas, how it's factually wrong and so on, through to ignoring it and even capitulating against it. Then there was Zionism, a response amongst overwhelmingly Eastern European Jews to anti-Semitism, which was the argument that Jews need a homeland of their own in order to be safe. And what I want to talk about now is the emergence and the logic of Zionism. In early 1995, a very fashionable Viennese playwright and writer of belles lettres, journalist called Theodor Herzl, fantasized about the collective conversion of the Jews in a mass ceremony at the Cathedral of St. Stephen in Vienna. Herzl was a Jew, but a very secular Jew. And he thought, you know, if I can make it, if I can become a famous playwright and a well-known journalist and work for the Neue Freie Presse, which was the main organ of Viennese liberalism, then surely there is a possibility for all Jews to become integrated into society. And he even thinks about, you know, the possibility of mass conversion. However, within much less than a year, his whole attitude changed as a consequence of being a correspondent for the Neue Freie Presse in Paris and seeing the Dreyfus Affair. He sees the Dreyfus Affair, and here is enlightened France, where Jews have been emancipated from feudal forms of oppression by the great French Revolution of 1789 to 1794. France, which should be a beacon of enlightenment, and what's happening? A Jew is being persecuted for being a Jew. And in some ways, I guess you could see Alfred Dreyfus as a kind of military Theodor Herzl. He was a secular Jew who'd made it in, you know, a mainstream kind of an institution, and he was being shot down, he was being persecuted, framed up for being a Jew. In his Zionist diary that he began writing in June 1895, Herzl wrote, "In Paris, as I have said, I achieved a freer attitude toward anti-Semitism, which I now began to understand historically and to pardon. Above all, I recognise the emptiness and futility of trying to combat anti-Semitism." In other words, what he concluded from the Dreyfus Affair was that anti-Semitism was inevitable where Jews and non-Jews lived together. And it's in that sense that he pardoned the anti-Semites, because what they were doing was essentially something that was inevitable and natural. His conclusion was that it was necessary for Jews to have their own state, and he wrote a very influential book, I mean, the founding document of political Zionism, called Der Judenstaat, which means the Jewish state, in 1896, although he began articulating these ideas already the year before. Both Zionists and anti-Semites regarded Jews and Gentiles as incapable of living together peacefully. They regarded this as impossible. Now, for the anti-Semites, the solution was, we'll get rid of the Jews. You know, kill them, make them go away. For the Zionists, the solution was Jews have to have their own separate territory, their own state. This could, what's more, appeal to people who didn't like Jews, because it would mean that you could take unwanted Jews off the hands of European states where there were, you know, rather too many of them. In 1912, Chaim Weizmann, later the president of the World Zionist Organization and later the first president of Israel, he told an audience in Berlin, "Each country can absorb only a limited number of Jews. If she doesn't want disorders in her stomach, Germany already has too many Jews." This is not Hitler. This is somebody who was already a worked-out Zionist at that stage and becomes one of the key leading figures of the Zionist movement and then of the Israeli state. And the strategy of political Zionism, the idea that Jews needed their own state, had existed as a kind of a literary current and a sentiment well before Herzl. But Zionism as an organised political movement effectively begins with Herzl. There's a few developments before that, but he's a very talented publicist and quite a good organiser. The strategy of political Zionism was to find a territory somewhere, settle Jews on it. How would you get a territory? Well, you'd go to people who have territory. Who has territory? Imperialist powers. They not only have territory, but they have force, they have might, they have strength. And if you can win them over to the project of a Jewish state, well then, your problems are solved. The difficulty was that Herzl approached the Tsar. The Tsar, who presides over the pogroms in Russia, he approaches the Ottoman Caliph, and they're not keen. They're not keen on the idea, but the strategy is you find an imperial sponsor. And around 1905, the Zionist movement splits between mainstream Zionists and what are called territorialists, because there's some calculation that the British Empire might be a bit sympathetic. But the British Empire, at this stage, doesn't actually control Palestine, but they do control large lumps of Africa, which they don't really know terribly much what to do with. So it was the idea that maybe the British Empire would give the Jews as a territory for their state some of Uganda. And the Zionist movement actually splits over this question. Eventually, the British Empire decides that they don't particularly want to give Uganda to the Jews. So the territorialist current dies away. Eventually, after the First World War, Britain is in possession of Palestine. And already in 1917, there's a Balfour Declaration which expresses sympathy for the project of a Jewish state in Palestine, which is really ideal, because a Jewish state in an area that is associated with the Jews going back to biblical times. So that is what the argument is. The dominant current of Zionists actually in Israel, in Palestine, from the 1930s to the 1970s are Labour Zionists. Their emphasis is on workers. Their concern is with the colonisation of Palestine, the occupation of Palestine, the displacement of the original inhabitants of Palestine by Jews and particularly by workers. They claim to be socialists, but everything was subordinated to the national project of creating a Jewish state in Palestine. Ze'ev Sternhell, who is an Israeli historian, who's not especially left-wing, he's a sort of a small L-liberal, and a historian of ideas rather than a historical materialist, nevertheless has written quite an interesting book called The Founding Myths of Israel. And he points out that Zionism is based ideologically on a mystical idea of the state being the most important thing. Not individuals, and Sternhell is a bit critical of this because he's a liberal, but the state is the most important thing. And he points out that for the socialist Zionists, the socialist and inverted commas Zionists, a Jew who did not intend to settle in Palestine and who did not prepare his children to do so was considered a useless Jew. So the only useful Jews, the only Jews that those who were committed to the Zionist project, really committed to it, were interested in, were those who were prepared to come to Palestine. The Zionist national project involved the creation of a national myth. It involved the invention of the Jewish people, essentially the invention of the Jewish race that stretched from, really from Adam, but certainly from Moses, through to the present in an uninterrupted line of descent and also of commitment to the same faith. What this did was, and also by and large united since the diaspora, since Jews no longer controlled the states that they had in ancient Palestine, a perpetual persecution from that point onward. This involved a denial of the descent of any modern Palestinians from ancient Jews. And if you want to really find descendants of ancient Jews, that's you go amongst the Fellayin of Palestine. That's where the real descendants of ancient Jews are. It involved denying that, and it involved denying that there had been converts to Judaism. In fact, really rather large converts to Judaism over a very long period of time. Because, you know, we're talking about from the destruction of the Jewish states in Palestine through to the middle of the 19th century. There were converts to Judaism in various parts of the Roman Empire, in what is now modern-day Yemen, amongst Berbers of North Africa, and in a Turkic empire that's sort of north of the Black Sea, stretching around through to the Caspian, of the Khazars. And it seems as though descendants of the Khazars, I mean the Khazar monarch converted to Judaism, squeezed between Christian empires and Muslim empires in the Middle Ages, they decided that it would be a really good idea to have a strong monotheistic religion that was different from these other empires, and, well, Judaism was there waiting to be adopted. The Khazars, it seems, descendants are the antecedents of quite a lot of Eastern European Jewry. Now, the colonisation of Israel went on. There were early pre-political Zionist colonisers, Jewish colonisers of Israel. Didn't achieve not very many of them. Then there was a more consistent kind of an effort with the development of the political Zionist movement. That process accelerated during the British occupation, or at least the first decade or so of the British occupation of Palestine, until the Palestinian inhabitants of Palestine started kicking up a stink, at which point the British began to curtail Jewish occupation, Jewish settlement of Palestine. What I want to talk about now is the way in which the cause of Zionism was dramatically advanced in the developed capitalist world, really in the Western capitalist world, by the Holocaust. Because the Zionist project was a marginal issue before then. I won't go into the causes of the Holocaust, the murder of around 6 million Jews here, beyond the connection between it and the reactionary Nazi response to the crisis of capitalism of the Great Depression. What's important is that the Holocaust presented a massive opportunity for Zionists. Some more unprincipled and disgraceful Zionist leaders were actually prepared to collaborate with the Nazis in order to advance the Zionist cause. It's the case of Reshow Kastner, who basically traded between 1,000 and 2,000 Jews, a trainload, who were allowed to leave Hungary for the fate of 400,000 Hungarian Jews who were not informed about what was awaiting them under the Nazis. But this fits in with that position that Sternhell identifies. What is a useful Jew? A useful Jew is somebody who is prepared to go to Eretz Israel, to go to Palestine, to engage in the Zionist project. I should point out here that there were heroic Zionists in the fight against the Nazis, including in the Warsaw Ghetto. I mean, that has to be said as well. It's not as though every Zionist was a Kastner. However, there was a logic to Kastner's politics and to his behaviour. So the Holocaust provides an opportunity, particularly after the war, when the scale of the destruction of the Jews becomes apparent, for the Zionists to gain very widespread sympathy. You know, these appalling things were done to the Jews. It's terrible. What can be done to make this good, to prevent it from happening again? And the Zionists answered, well, support a Jewish state in Palestine, support the foundation of Israel. After the foundation of Israel, A book and a movie called Exodus played a fairly important role in this process. I mean, the book was published in 1958 and the movie came out in 1960s. Anybody actually heard of this before? Ah, good. That's a relief. It was really a very, very sympathetic, utterly sympathetic portrayal of the whole Zionist project. The movie concentrates on a particular part of the project around the formation of the state of Israel. Very, very sympathetic. The Jews are victims, but some of them are prepared to fight back. And they've done so against all the odds, and Arabs, to the extent that they appear, are demonised, you know, they're devils and so on. You wouldn't want to be sympathetic from them. It's interesting that the book, which was on the New York Times bestseller list for almost 2 years, it was the biggest thing since Gone with the Wind as a book. From the start, Exodus had the backing of the Israeli Foreign Office. Ilan Hartuf, acting for the Foreign Office, accompanied Uris, which the author is Leon Uris, around Israel and taught him about the history of the state. When the novel came out, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion sent Uris a letter of congratulation, and the film received similar kind of logistical support from the Israeli state. Well, the Zionist dream has been realised. There is what calls itself a Jewish state in Palestine. A Jewish state in the sense that it's a racist state. That Jews have a privileged status there by virtue of being Jewish, and according to the rabbinical hierarchy in Israel, to demonstrate you're Jewish, you basically have to demonstrate Jewish descent through the mother, a Jewish bloodline. Essentially a racist definition of who a Jew is. So a Jewish state exists, privileged status for the Jews, for Jews in Israel. Anybody from around the world who can demonstrate that they're Jewish can make aliyah, can go to Israel, migrate there and become a citizen. I might have some problems with that, given my statements over a fairly prolonged period of time, most recently renouncing my right to make aliyah publicly. But anybody else who isn't a self-hating Jew, like me, can actually do this. On the other hand, Palestinians who are born in Israel and may actually be Palestinians who are Israeli citizens, their language is a second-class language. The history that they're taught in school is Zionist history. They are not allowed to own land in certain parts of the country or to buy certain areas of land in the country. They're second-class citizens. And then there are the people who were born in Palestine and the descendants of those who were born in Palestine who were expelled or who were born after their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents now were expelled, who have no right of return to Israel. Jews have a right of return because of this mythical history of the Jewish people, but Palestinians who were born there have no right of return if they have been driven out at various stages. So in the immediate post-war period, Israel, with significant assistance, wins its war of independence. It has fairly widespread popular sympathy because of the Holocaust and the instrumentalization of the Holocaust, the use of the Holocaust as an argument, including in popular culture by books and films like Exodus. So there's a Jewish state which is expanded through a series of wars. Has this made Jews safer in the world? Well, actually, the creation of a Jewish state has created permanent insecurity for the population of Israel because of the colonial structure of the Israeli state and because of the role that Israel has played as a vanguard of imperialism in the region. And I'm not going to go into that because there was a whole stream at the conference that was all about that. The identification of all Jews with the Zionist state by Israel and its allies leads all Jews, if you take the Zionist propaganda seriously, all Jews to be blamed for the crimes of the Zionist state. And what this does is to legitimise the ideas that Jews anywhere are targets for terrorist attacks by people who are enraged by what the Israeli state has done, but do not have an effective strategy for responding to Israeli repression of Arabs and Muslims. And a recent example of this is the way in which Zionists have responded to the assassination of Mahmoud al-Mabhouh on the 20th of January 2010. Well, to start with, the Israeli state was so concerned with the well-being of Jews that it used the passports of people who were dual citizens of Israel and somewhere else as part of that plot to murder al-Mabhouh. Paul Howes, who is the General Secretary of the Australian Workers' Union, a particularly nasty piece of work, a vehement supporter of Israel, said that the death of al-Mabhouh is a positive outcome for those who believe in peace and justice. Is this something that makes Jews safer? This kind of a statement. This kind of a safer statement, along with the identification of Jews and the interests of Jews and the interests of Israel, makes Jews everywhere more insecure because they are blamed for what the Israeli state does. Not only for the assassination, for the murder of al-Mabhouh, but also for what's happened in Gaza recently and for the whole history of Israeli genocidal policy against the Palestinians. So Zionism, it should be acknowledged, has worked for the Israeli ruling class and for US imperialism. It's expanded their territory and their power. Combined with the massive aid from the United States, Zionism has bound ordinary Israelis, what's more, including workers, to their rulers. But Israel remains an obstacle to the security of Jews around the world and in Palestine. And it's an obstacle to the security of the people of the Middle East and especially the security, the well-being of the Palestinian people.